The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the author events office, and I basically jockeyed to get to introduce tonight's author, who is Don Winslow. So please don't tell the rest of this season's lineup of speakers, but a few days ago it occurred to me that tonight's guest was perhaps to be, for me, the highlight of our winter and spring events. And what auspicious timing, given several recent events, including the continuing and yet somehow also renewed controversy over a proposed wall at our southern border, the very recent criminal conviction of El Chapo in a New York federal court, and the even more recent revelation that he may even receive a new trial. All this, of course, set against the backdrop of America's ongoing opioid epidemic. And there might be no better person than tonight's author to help us tie it all together, the politics, the violence, the personalities, and the roots of this saga and how far into the earth they go and the dark fruit they've borne. Don Winslow is the son of a sailor and a librarian. He's a journalist. He has a degree in African studies. He has been a movie theater manager, a safari guide in Kenya, a New York private investigator, a director of Shakespearean productions in Oxford, England, a trial consultant, a film and television writer, and is a husband and father. He also writes books. The author of numerous international best-selling crime novels, Mr. Winslow is the recipient of dozens of awards and spots on myriad best books of the year lists. These books include, but are not limited to, the winner of Frankie Machine, The Force, and Savages, for which he wrote the screenplay for the Oliver Stone directed film adaptation of the same name. Tonight he presents The Border, the epic conclusion to the Cartel trilogy that began with The Power of the Dog and The Cartel. Esquire calls it an epic, gritty, south of the border godfather for our time. Though I'm only so far about 70 pages in, I call it a masterpiece. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Don Winslow to the Free Library.
Thank you. Thanks, it's nice to be here. Thanks for asking me, and thanks for coming out tonight. I really appreciate it, you know. I've done events where far fewer people showed up. I've done events where no one showed up. I did a book signing one time in Laguna Beach, California, with a book set in Laguna Beach, California. I was supposed to be there for 2 hours. After an hour, no one had come, and the store owner left and asked me to lock up. And being the Irish Catholic boy that I am, I stayed for the whole hour by myself and locked up. Another time at a bookstore in Sunset Strip, Los Angeles, one person showed up. He was very drunk and insisted that I was William Burroughs. And he kept coming up and hugging me and saying, "Mr. Burroughs, I love your work." And I said, "Dude, I'm not William Burroughs." And "Mr. Burroughs, Naked Lunch, you know, meant everything to me. It's great. It's a great book. I'm not William Burroughs, you know." And finally said, "Dude, you know, I hate to break this to you. William Burroughs is dead." And it didn't do a thing. And I finally said, "Did you drive here?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Well, I'll make you a deal. I'll have the owner of the bookstore call you a cab. And when you're in the back seat of the cab, I'll sign Naked Lunch for you. Just don't tell anybody that I'm alive." So we got him a cab, he got in the back seat, I got the owner to give me a paperback of Naked Lunch, and I signed it, and off he went. So these are the humiliations that go on in the course of a, you know, 20-some-odd-year career. I am, by the way, not the only novelist, Don Winslow. I don't want to disappoint anyone here tonight. There's another Don Winslow from Philadelphia. Yeah, he writes porn novels. And of all the names in the world, of all the lousy gin joints in the world, he had to pick my name for his gnome de porn. It's not his real name. I'm not going to give his real name. But I'm not signing any of his books here tonight. I did not write Slave Girls of Rome, Katrina in Charge, or Ironwood 1 through 7, the continuing saga of a private British boarding school for girls. I learned about the other Don Winslow when I was still a private investigator. I was doing a case in San Antonio, and what I do at nights when I have nothing else to do is I go to bookstores. My wife, I think, uncharitably refers to these evenings as dweeb's night out. Never worries about me being in strip clubs or brothels. I'm in bookstores. And I was in a bookstore in San Antonio, prowling the shelves. And you know how you do it with your head crooked like that? Because you're all book people. You wouldn't be here. You know this exactly. You're looking at like that. And I see Ironwood 4 by Don Winslow. And it took me a second. So I'm Don Winslow. And I don't remember writing Ironwood 1, 2, or 3, never mind 4. And then I pick the book up out of the shelf, and I start reading it, and I blush violently. It's this S&M erotica on the shelf of this bookstore. Nothing is accomplished. No act of love is accomplished in this book without whips and pulleys and ropes. It's like Aeneas Neen meets Patrick O'Brien, you know. It's a bizarre book, and I'm upset. And I think I should show this book to my publisher, the great Sonny Mehta at Knopf, and I should show it to my agent, but I'm embarrassed to buy the book. And then I decide the only thing more embarrassing than buying a sleazy porn book is getting caught stealing a sleazy porn. So I got very clever. I bought a John Updike book to make me look literary, and a book of African history, and the New Testament. And I slipped Ironwood 4. And I stand in line, and there's like a very kind of librarian-looking, stern-looking lady at one counter, and a kind of middle-aged, slightly sleazy-looking guy at another, and a teenage girl with big blue eyes. And I'm hoping for the middle-aged sleazy guy. I get the teenage girl with the crucifix and the big blue eyes, and I'm appalled at the whole thing. And she does the Updike book, and she does the African history, she does the New Testament, and then she comes to Ironwood 4. And all I want is out of this bookstore. I just want to get this transaction done, and I hand her my American Express card. Yeah. It took you a few seconds, but you got there. She looks at Ironwood 4, the sleazy porn book by Don Winslow. She looks at the American Express card with the name Don Winslow. She freaks out. I freak out. I'm standing there hopping up and down like, you know, Rumpelstiltskin on crack, trying to point to the crime section, saying, I'm that Don Winslow. So anyway, this is just my way of avoiding talking about the book. Talking about the book for 3 days. Solid, this beginning of this book tour, the publisher's not here, so what do I care, right? You know, but you probably care. So I will talk about the book. I probably will talk about the book more in the format of questions and answers rather than me making a speech about the book. I think that might be more interesting and more fun if we had more of a conversation. But I know I have to talk for a while, so I'll continue talking for a few more minutes. What I would like to talk about really, though, are libraries, because we're in one, and how important they are. And how important a library was to me. Jason was kind enough to give a little bio and allude to the fact that my mother was a librarian. I often say my father was a sailor who loved books. My mother was a librarian who loved a sailor. And I grew up in a little New England fishing town obviously on the coast in Rhode Island, in this old 19th century library that my mom worked at, where silence was not allowed. And in fact, the head librarian had an Alaskan Malamute that she would tie to the book cart and ride the book cart around and put books up. And that library, you know, growing up in a kind of remote place where you do have kind of an inferiority complex about the big world out there, you were pretty much expected to be a fisherman. But I had this library. And I could go there any time. And I realized at a quite young age that I could not only travel across space in that library, I could go anywhere I wanted. If I wanted to go to Africa, I could go. I wanted to go to England or China, out west. Anywhere I wanted to go, I could go in that library, which was much smaller than this room. I could also travel across time. You know, if I wanted to read something in the 20th century, I could, but if I wanted to go to the 1600s or the 1400s or the 1800s, I could go across time as well. And in that library, I learned to love to read. You know, it was encouraged at home. My parents let us read anything we wanted at any age. You know, I was 11 and 12 and was reading Hemingway and Fitzgerald and those guys. I was never censored. We never had to go to bed, my sister or I, as long as we were reading a book. If we were in bed reading a book, there was no lights out. We'd fall asleep reading. And it's no coincidence. There are two kids in the Winslow family, both became professional novelists. My sister Christine Rolofson wrote, I think, 46 romance novels, is very successful at it. Two kids, both professional writers, because we read, because we were encouraged to read and read anything. And you know, I think a lot these days about democracy and the state of our democracy and how democracy really came about in England and in this country. And I don't think it's any coincidence at all that you see democracies rising at the same time you see the beginnings of free lending libraries. Because what a revolutionary idea this is. That we're going to take knowledge, the most powerful thing that there is, and make it available to everyone. It's the most revolutionary, most democratic idea and institution in our societies, that anybody can walk through these doors and have access to the world through time, through space, can read for pleasure, can read for research, can wander shelves with no clear intent of what they want, just to wander and see what's there and find something new, find a new interest, find something wonderful. So I'm always really happy, and thank you guys very much, when I'm invited to speak at a library, because they mean so much to me. I would not have become a writer without a library. You know, so I'm very grateful to be here. I'm grateful you're here. And I think what I'll do, if it's acceptable to the organizers, I'll just give you a brief introduction to the book. It's the third part and final part, obviously, of a trilogy. That's what trilogy means, you know. And I have followed a number of characters, but principally a DEA agent named Art Keller, through 30-some-odd years of the war on drugs. He starts in Mexico in 1977 in the first book, The Power of the Dog, as a young, idealistic DEA agent. And in the second book, The Cartel, which treats the really hyper-violent era that Mexico endured, he's more of a cynic. In the third book, I bring him home. The third book, Art Keller becomes the head of the Drug Enforcement Administration. And he finds as much corruption here as he ever found in Mexico. When he goes after the money, he changes tactics. And instead of going after the drugs themselves, he goes after the money. The book also follows the life of a 10-year-old Guatemalan boy as he comes up from Guatemala. The slums of Guatemala, he literally lives in a garbage dump and is threatened by gangs and has to leave. And it follows his journey north. It follows the life of a young woman heroin addict. What I'm trying to do in this book, in a fictional sense, in a novel sense, I'm a crime writer. I embrace that. I'm not a political writer. I'm not a literary writer. I write crime fiction. You know, it's where I live. But I wanted to get beneath some of the headlines, you know, that have become labels, really. The immigration problem, the heroin epidemic, you know, and try to bring the reader into that world on an individual basis, you know, with one or two people that you follow their lives. So that's what this book is. It ends Art Keller's long battle in the war on drugs, and I won't tell you how, but that's the border. And that's why I'm here tonight, and I think I'd just like to open it up to questions and we'll have a conversation. Is that okay to do? Or if you don't ask questions, I'll just keep telling stories. So, you know, you're warned.
How did you determine that, or how did you decide to write crime novels? Mm-hmm. You know, that's interesting to me.
Yeah, thank you. It's interesting to me, too. You know, I didn't start reading crime literature till I was in my early 20s. And I was a PI. I was on Times Square in New York and elsewhere, sometimes chasing runaways, sometimes making minor drug deals, you know, drug buys. And I thought, you know, it might be fun to read about what I do. And so I picked up Raymond Chandler. I picked up Elmore Leonard. I picked up Lawrence Block. It was, in a sense, albeit in a very romantic and heightened sense, talking about my life. But what I loved about it was the poetry of it. I loved the language of it. And I got thinking, you know, because I'd always wanted to be a writer since I was a little kid. I thought I was going to be a playwright. I was a lousy playwright. And then I thought, well, okay, maybe I'll try this. Because I loved reading. I used to read crime books on stakeouts, you know, just a few words at a time, look up, you know, a few words at a time, look. But it took me years to get the confidence to do it. You know, I was afraid of it for a long, long time. Did that answer the question you asked me, ma'am? Sure. Pleasure.
First, thank you for coming and speaking to us. Second, you've almost tempted us not to ask questions because you tell such great stories, but
we can hang out later.
But my interest is, to what extent have you patterned your most recent books based on what you see going on in the DEA, and do you have any sort of concrete suggestions? If you were made head of the DEA, what changes would you make, or what policies would you want to continue with?
Yeah, thank you. There's little chance of my being made head of the DEA. Although I have many friends in DEA. And some people who in DEA don't like me very much, and I understand it. Because, sir, my prescription for the drug problem is to legalize drugs. So, look, we've been doing the same thing for 50 years. And what's the result? Drugs are more powerful, more plentiful, and cheaper than they've ever been. We have had more people die of overdoses in the last 2 years than ever, more than have been killed in car accidents or gun violence. So I don't want to preach. I get crazy on this topic, so stop me. You can get the hook out any time. Look, we'll never, ever solve this problem on the production end or on the interdiction end. It can only be solved on the consumption end. And because we're not asking the right questions, we don't get the right answers. We Americans are 5% of the world's population. We use 80% of the world's opioids. That can't just be from injured backs. Opioids are always a response to pain. Thank God, sir, that they're a response to pain. But we're not asking the question, what's the pain? You know, what is the pain that drives us to use these sorts of drugs at that level? We're not asking the base questions. Is it emotional? Is it psychological? Is it physical? Is it economic? Is it racial? Sometimes I think it's loneliness. I think we're a very lonely culture. And I think that the more technology we invent to communicate, the less we actually do it. This is becoming rare. We're very lucky in a facility like this. I saw your calendar. It's amazing. 180-something events a year. But it's more and more rare for us to look each other in the eye, be together and sharing a space, and talk to each other. We're doing this. You know, I swear the two biggest problems in America are carpal tunnel syndrome and the opioid epidemic. Birds used to tweet. Now we do. And I'm as guilty as anybody. I'm very active on Twitter because I'm kind of pissed off about things lately and I've been shooting my mouth off. So my prescription for the drug problem is pretty radical, some people say, but I think it's pretty radical to have 2.2 million people in jail. I think it's pretty radical to spend $88 billion a year on something that doesn't work. Did I answer your question? Sort of? Well, yeah. I mean, we should be putting more money on treatment than we put on interdiction. We should be furthering education in the jails and prison systems. One of the best things that's happened to me in the last 5 years after my last book, a police chief, I can't tell you the city, called me up and he said, you're just the left-wing liberal kind of blippity-blip that I can't stand, but you might have some good ideas. I have my prisoners for 30, 60, and 90 days. 85% of them test positive for drugs when they come in, and I'm wasting that time. What do you think? And I said, what do you think about putting a treatment center in the jail? And he said, could you help me do that? And I said, no, I'm not qualified, but I can put you in touch with the people who are. We need to be doing that. For every dollar we spend on education in prison, we save $5 in reduced recidivist costs. Who wouldn't make that bargain? That's a no-brainer deal. And this is not a right or left issue. This is an issue of common sense and humanity and compassion. It can be simply a fiscal issue if you want to take it from that viewpoint. So that's what I'd say to politicians, but they don't call me.
Before my question, I want to thank you for providing me for a very long time with tens of hours of entertainment reading your books.
Thank you very much. It's very kind of you. Thank you.
You're, if not the one of my absolute favorite authors.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
And I want to thank you for, as you said, I think you said shouting your mouth off on Twitter, because I follow you very much on Twitter. I've read your most recent article, I think it was in the New York Post, about the trail of drugs, and it's so necessary for people like you.
Thank you.
To do that. And I also want to thank you for introducing me to so many other authors like Steve Hamilton and the other people in your group.
Great.
So now my question. I think you said that after the border, you're done with the war on drugs as a writing project.
Yeah.
So what's next?
I'm not saying in public. I don't mean to be rude. I'm not ready to put it out there yet. I've finished it. Yeah, and then I come on the road for a month or so. And so that's a good time for me to set it down. So when I go back to it, I'll look at it again and see if it's any good or not. You know, it could be terrible. I kind of like it. But I need to move on, both in terms of substance and style. There are things I want to try stylistically, you know, that wouldn't fit the format of the last two or three books. It'll be in the crime genre. Again, that's where I live, so, you know, it's not a radical bust out, but it'll be quite different. It's possible there's a little surfing in it. I think people are going to be a little surprised at what's there, and I think you might see some old friends reemerge. Yes, sir.
So quick question. I love the story about you and your sister both being avid readers and then becoming authors. What was the spark that made you make that leap from being a reader to a writer? You know, Hunter S. Thompson famously talks about typing out the novels of Hemingway and Fitzgerald to get the rhythm, to get the voice. Yeah. What was the inspiration that made you evolve from just being a voracious reader to being an actual writer?
Thank you. Listen, I've always wanted to do it. And I tried it as a playwright. I had a few plays produced, but, you know, meh. And then I think I had a crisis of confidence, to be really honest with you. I wouldn't come here to lie to you, you know, where I didn't think I could do it. And I kept talking about doing it. What I've learned over the last X number of years is you can either talk about writing or write. You can't do much of both. And I was in Oxford directing Twelfth Night, maybe, I don't know. And the guy who runs that program, who I had dinner with last night in New York, he's a professor of literature at Barnard, he said, you know, Winslow, you've been talking about writing this book forever, but you don't do it. Why not? Several weeks later, I was in Africa doing a safari, and I had a malaria relapse and amoebic dysentery, and I'm 5 a.m. around a fire down in the Maasai Mara shaking. And I thought, damn, you better start writing this book. And then I had heard Joseph Wambaugh, the great police writer, say on the radio that when he was a L.A. homicide cop, he wanted to be a writer, and he decided he was going to write 10 pages a day no matter what. And I thought, I can't do 10, I can do 5. And from that day on, I wrote 5 pages a day, no matter what, no matter where I was. And I was in Africa, I was in China, I was in England, I was in California. I wrote on buses, trains, planes, tents, hotels, houses, wherever I was, by hand, 5 pages a day. About 3 years later, I had a book. Now, the world did not agree with that assessment. The first 15 publishers who read it turned it down, including the publisher I'm with now. I remind them of that, you know, on a daily basis. But while I was getting rejection letters, I was writing my second book. And I'd read somewhere that out of every 10,000 people who put down writer as their occupation on the tax returns, one makes a living at it. Now, any sane person would give it up. But I said to myself, look, I sincerely feel badly for the other 9,999. But in this life, that's my slot. And, you know, I got a publishing contract with St. Martin's for 2 books. Paid a whopping $7,000 a book. I was 7 published books into my career before I could quit my day job. You know, but you just kept at it. So it was a combination of my buddy at Oxford, malaria, and Joseph Wambaugh.
Yes, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Have you seen the TV series Breaking Bad?
Yes.
What do you think of that?
Well, I liked it. I thought it was good. I had a hard time. Listen, the acting's fantastic and the scripts are fantastic. I like all those people a lot. I had a difficult time watching it, sir, because it's too much of a busman's holiday. You know what I mean? It's like I'm sitting there writing about drug cartels all day. Kind of the last thing I'm going to do in my spare time is watch more about drug cartels. But I watched quite a bit of it. Bryan Cranston's terrific. The kid in it, I forget his name, Paul Aaron. Yeah, terrific. You know, a lot of the kind of characters that came in and out, I thought were great. Listen, like any television show, it's heightened reality. Do you know what I mean? It's a little more than real. And if you look at the body count, it's surprising there's anyone left in Albuquerque. I went there and I was surprised to see like people walking around. You know, it's like Lexington, Kentucky, you know, with Justified. You know, I'm surprised anyone's there, you know, because he killed so many folks. But, yeah, it was good. It was good. It wasn't The Sopranos. Look, I think that if we're going to look at crime series, You know, I think we have to go back to Hill Street Blues. Yeah, let's hear it for Hill Street Blues. What the? And then NYPD Blue, and then Homicide, and then the Homicide crew gave us The Wire. You know, the best line I think ever written for American television was in episode one of The Wire. Aren't you glad you asked me a question? Because I just go blah, 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 blah. I've had a lot of coffee, much more coffee than sleep. The McNulty, the lead cop, is with a bunch of gang kids, one of whom becomes Michael B. Jordan, the big star. And they're playing craps, shooting craps, and Snot Boogie, one of the characters, takes the money every time. And McNulty says to Michael B. Jordan, he says, let me ask you something. Why is it if every time you let Snot Boogie play, he takes the money, why do you let him play? Best line in American television, coming up. And Michael B. Jordan says, got to. It's America, man.
Did you write your last book in order to have a platform regarding your views on the drug?
No. Thank you for asking that question. It's funny, I was just having that conversation with a publicist in a taxi on the way to the train station. No. I'm shocked and a little appalled that I have become some sort of pundit and that I have a platform. It's nothing I ever wanted. I just want to be a crime writer and tell good stories, you know, but, however. When I was writing Cartel, the middle book of this, it was a tough, tough time. You know, that book is dedicated to 138 journalists who were murdered. This book is dedicated to 43 college kids who were slaughtered on a bus. I've been on this beat for over 20 years, living with heroin addicts, with the families of teenagers who've been killed in prisons. And I started to feel like I was just a voyeur. And it's funny how talks wrap around, sort of like a pornographer of violence. I felt that I owed something to those victims because I make a good living and I have a nice life. And every year and a half or 2 years when a book of mine comes out, there's a window for me where people might listen to what I have to say. And so when Cartel came out, I took a full-page ad out in the Washington Post advocating the legalization of drugs. And since then, apparently, I have a platform or I'm some sort of pundit or something. I don't quite get it. It doesn't shut me up, though. And I think that in the last couple of years, and I'm not, I don't say this is a good thing, ma'am. It's just what it is. I'm really angry. And so I guess I've felt a need to speak out more on real life issues and do more journalism and more articles and editorials and Twitter to speak out on some of these things. Because, and I don't want to make myself appear noble. Listen, the heroes are those 138. It's now more like 200 journalists who are killed. You know, but I feel I owe something, and that's the way I can pay it back, you know.
I just want to ask a little bit about your research.
Sure.
And just your process for that, because I find your books, especially the crime novels, mm-hmm. to be very on the nose and impeccably researched. And
thank
just
you.
Curious, you know, what that process is. Do
yeah.
you travel to these places?
I have a very anal retentive way I do research. I'm very strict about it. I start with history because I was trained as a historian and I believe in chronology. I believe in cause and effect. And so when I started, for instance, on this story in 1998, whew, I started reading Latin American history back to the Aztecs and the Mayans. Once I feel I have a decent grasp of history, I start reading journalism, nonfiction books, newspapers, magazines. When that starts becoming redundant, I go to documents, court records, trial transcripts, DEA, FBI, CIA, police reports. When I feel that I have enough information that I'm no longer ignorant, that's when I go out and talk to people. Because I don't want to waste their time or mine with broad questions that I should know already, you know? So typically, if I go to a source or a witness, I'm not so interested in what happened because I kind of already know, you know? I'm more interested in how they felt about it, what they think about it, what's their daily life like. And I call it the process of becoming the chair. You know how when you buy a new chair for your house or your apartment, for the first 2 weeks, all you see is that chair? Every time you walk in the room, it's the chair. After a couple of weeks, it's the chair. That's kind of my process. You know, when I was doing a book called The Force about the NYPD, I just hung around with cops. For the first couple of weeks, I'm the chair. Yeah, I'm the chair. And it's the same with drug traffickers and DEA people and addicts and gangbangers and all of that, you know. And writers like to talk too much, as you're experiencing tonight. But we have to discipline ourselves to listen a lot more than we talk. And when I listen, that's when I get the music. You know what I mean? That's when I start to hear dialogue and rhythms and things that I think make it a novel as opposed to journalism. Is that answering the question you asked? Yes. Thank you. Yeah, yes, sir, and back.
Don, thanks so much for being here tonight. This is really enjoyable. A stylistic question, if I could.
Sure.
It's either Savages or Kings of Cool. Chapter one is one single expletive. And I think it's Power of the Dog. Art Keller is watching the burning of fields and talking about the history of opioids in the war.
Yeah.
How you said in getting out of this trilogy, you needed to put that style away and mm-hmm. go to something else. How do you either sort of, does the muse say you're going to write more casually this time? Or how do you choose style to style to style? Because I think someone without your name on the flyleaf, someone could very actively read three or four of your novels and not know they're the same writer.
Which has been a problem in my career, because bookstores have not known where to shelve me. No, seriously, you know, they typically want to know if you're Corn Flakes or your Rice Krispies or your Raisin Bran, and then I've been like Corn Flakes, Rice Krispies, and Raisin Bran. Oh, I don't know what to do with that. To answer the question that you asked me, though, Frank Lloyd Wright famously said, form follows function. I think in writing, style follows story. So first I have a story that I want to tell. The style has to conform, has to be right for that story and those characters. You know? Now, I write first drafts very fast. You know what I mean? I write first drafts like I'm being chased. You know, like I'm about to be caught for not being a writer, you know, and hauled away from my keyboard. Which I seriously some days think is going to happen. And in writing fast, the appropriate style just seems to come out and happen. I also read aloud to myself, particularly the dialogue. And it's not that I'll hear when things are right, but I'll hear when things are wrong. I'll hear the wrong note. I'll hear the flat or the sharp. And then I'm able to fix it. You know, so with sort of heavier books like this trilogy, it demands a certain kind of weightier kind of narrative sense, although I love switching points of view. You know, so if I get away from Keller, who sometimes bores the hell out of me, I'm not even sure I like the guy, and I'll go over to a character called Crazy Eddie, who's giving you this sort of wise-ass take on what he's seeing and experiencing, or in this book I'll go to this 10-year-old kid, Nico, and through his point of view, you're seeing a much more innocent, kind of, you know, discovering life as it happens kind of take. So switching point of view also really helps with that, because you're literally switching voice. You know, am I answering the question you're asking me? Yeah. So, but with Savages, to tell you a dirty secret, that started as a memo to an editor. I wrote F you. I didn't write F you. I wrote the whole word, you know. And then I thought, well, what about it? Who is saying this? Who is thinking this? And all of a sudden, I'm writing in the voice of a 26-year-old Orange County woman, which I'm not. And that book just took off. And I sent the first 14 pages I wrote in about 45 minutes. And I emailed it to my agent, and I said, either I'm onto really something really good or I'm just crazy. And he instantly wrote back and said, drop everything else you're doing and finish this. And it was a Janet Maslin review of that book that saved my career. If she hadn't given me a great review, my career would have been over. It was such a risk going to that voice and that stud. Can I tell one more story? Do you mind? Do y'all mind? So I wrote Savages, right? And then I'm over teaching in England, and I'm flying to give a talk in Milan. And I'm in Heathrow Airport at 5 in the morning. My son at that time was 17 years old. And the phone, my wife's phone rings. You know, we're in that early morning airport, miserable, you know, feeling. 5 in the morning. And she's on the phone, and it's my kid. And she goes pale. And she says, I hear her say, you'd better tell your father that yourself. Any of you parents of teenage sons? You know what's going through my mind, right? It's jail, someone's pregnant, you know. And she hands me the phone. I don't want the phone, but I have to be a father. I take the phone. I hear my son say, Dad, have you seen the New York Times this morning? I say, no, Thomas, it's 5:30 in the morning, I'm in England. But I know this review's coming out, and he must have heard the terror in my voice. And he says, no, Dad, it's a rave. So I hang up, and I'm just clever enough on the phone to call up the New York Times, and I read this, it's immodest, rave review from Janet Maslin. Seriously, man, otherwise my career's done. I'm over. So I fly to Milan, and I'm supposed to give this talk, and we get to the hotel, the flight's late, and all these very, very excited Italians grab me. So I have to go do a sound check for my talk that night. Like, sound check? It's not the E Street Band. You know, how tricky is this? So they take my wife and they shove her into the hotel and they shove me into a van. And there's a very distinguished elderly lady sitting across in the other bench of the van. It's Joyce Carol Oates. And I recognize her and I'm instantly intimidated. And I say, Ms. Oates, I'm Don Winslow. Nice to meet you. And she has a copy of the New York Times in her lap. And she looks over the newspaper. She says, oh, yes, you're the one who got that wonderful review in the Times this morning. So that's the story. But
actually, two questions, one sort of specific and more general. You mentioned that when you started, you had a 5-page-a-day pace. And I'm wondering, are you still on that pace? Or has that changed? And then I guess the B part of it is, do you have periods, because you mentioned your research and writing, do you have periods when you're, if you will, research only, not writing for, say, 3 months, and then you, okay, now I'm in a writing phase, and I go from there?
No, I wish.
And sorry, and then I got a second, related, more general question.
Let me answer these two first. I usually do better than 5 pages a day, but I no longer do it by pages. I do it by clock. I come from a blue-collar, you know, actually khaki-collar family. So I show up at work. You know what I mean? Like it's a factory job. You know, 5:30 a.m., the whistle blows, I'm at my desk. And I'm there. I take a break mid-morning and run or hike or something. And I work until 5:30 in the afternoon. So some days that, I think my record is 28 pages, and my other record is 0 pages, which I've hit many times. Yeah, there's some days this job, it's like dragging a cinder block over an asphalt parking lot. You know, it's just not going to be happy, and it sounds bad, you know. And some days are like that, and other days, you know, they just sing. I already forgot your second question. The research question. No, I got it. No, I typically I will write in the morning and research in the afternoon. Now, I can't always cut it that finely. You know, I mean, if I need to go talk to someone, obviously that's out the window. It might be a day or two, you know, out on the road or whatever. But my typical rhythm is I know that after about 1:30, 2 o'clock, anything I write, I'm going to throw away anyway. It's going to suck, you know. And so rather than just waste that time, then I go to research. I'll go to the documents, I'll go to the books, the whole process I alluded to, and then, or get on the phone. But other days, you know, I might just be driving to a penitentiary or a corner somewhere, you know.
You talked about your transition, if you will, from a reader to a writer.
Yeah.
Over that course, have there been, writers that you've come across that you think deserve more profile than they have? You know, could you throw out two or three names that we can then add to our lists and discover?
There's a guy right now named Lou Burney, wrote a book called November Road. It was just nominated for an LA Times Critics Award. I think Lou needs a lot more attention. You know, I look back at the past, you know, think about people like Jim Thompson, who died broke, and every book he ever wrote has been made into a movie. He'd have been a wealthy, wealthy guy. You know, the late James Crumley, you know, wrote The Last Good Kiss. Very big in Europe. I know the feeling. I was saying to these guys earlier, I'm sort of the David Hasselhoff of American crime writers. For years, I was very big in Germany and, you know, couldn't sell a book here. I sometimes feel like a jazz musician. Really, for the first 10 or 15 years of my career, I made most of my living in Europe. I'd be doing this in Munich, you know, and Torino and places like that. So there are a lot of guys, you know, but I mean... Jim Harrison is obviously a well-known writer, but I think Jim Harrison is the greatest American author who's never achieved that, you know, should be up there. I mean, I'll say it. I think Jim Harrison is a more important writer than Ernest Hemingway. And I think Richard Russo is a more important writer than Scott Fitzgerald. So, yeah.
Thanks for coming out. Huge fan of yours.
Thank you.
Personally, how would you rank your books from your most favorite to maybe some of your more least favorite?
I'll tell you what.
Thank you.
I get asked my most favorite question a lot, no offense. My most favorite book is the one I'm working on now. If I can give you any advice about writing or life its own self, because I've been around a while. Always be in love with the woman you're dancing with. Now, I've been dancing with the same actual woman for 33 years, and it's been really easy. But during those 33 years, I've written a lot of damn books, you know. You shouldn't write a book unless you're in love with it. Just don't do it. I've done it. I'm not going to give you the titles. There was a book I forgot to write. Forgot I was under contract. My agent at the time calls up and says, "You're not going to get that book in on time." "Oh, yeah, I got 6 months." He says, "You have 2 weeks." I wrote it in 10 days. And it shows. You know, it's not something I'm proud of. You always have a fondness for your first novel, you know, because it was such a struggle. Power of the Dog took me 6 years of my life that I thought would never end. I didn't think I was going to survive it. So there's a certain fondness for that. But I have to be passionate about what I'm working on right now.
First of all, I utterly reject that you're not a literary writer. The Cartel, I would put up against the best books in American literature.
God, well, you're very kind.
Well, and I can't wait to read this one. But I've read that I follow you on Twitter too, so I know how you feel about other types of entertainment that portray the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. I've also read that your books, this trilogy, has been optioned to become a movie, which is the way a lot of people get their information
right
these days. So I was wondering if you could speak to the responsibility you might feel, and then the responsibility you might be able to exercise over how this story, which is so important, ends up on a screen.
Yeah, I was in a two-hour meeting about that last night.
What a timely question I just asked.
There you did, man. You're dead on. It is in, as they say, development, and we'll see what form that takes. You know, I used to be that writer that said, just send me the check. I don't want anything to do with it. And then someone made a really bad movie of one of my books. I had no idea how much that would actually hurt, sitting there watching a book called Bobby Z, if you're on Pakistani National Airlines late at night and you piss them off, they'll show you that. With the late Paul Walker, who's, by the way, a wonderful guy. So I had to change the way that I worked with Hollywood, you know, and I went exactly 180 degrees, you know, starting with writing Savages. I don't want to write screenplays right now because I'm just involved with novels, but I insist to have a real seat at the table. And look, they're two different media. They're two different breeds of cat, you know what I mean? And film and TV have needs that the novel doesn't, and vice versa. I get that. And what I try to tell filmmakers, unsuccessfully usually, by the way, is, hey, dude, 2,000 years before you were editing, we were editing. You know, I'm damn sure Homer edited The Odyssey, right? You know? So I get cutting. I understand that. But if they're going to make changes, I want to know what kind of changes they are. The other key is the people you choose to work with. I'm only going to work with people when this is kind of a cliche, but we share a vision. And I've said, this is what I think this trilogy is, and almost more importantly, here's what I think this trilogy is not. And I'm not going to be, you know, breathing down your neck or anything like that. I'm not that guy. But don't betray me on this.
I'd be interested if you'd ever consider writing nonfiction, and in particular, since I'm a huge believer that the free press is extremely critical, and you have a passion, as highlighted by your recording the deaths of journalists that have been murdered, I really would hope you might write about a book about the importance of journalism and the sacrifices that these journalists have made to bring truth to the public.
You know, that's a really interesting idea I hadn't thought of, and I might consider it. It's a really interesting idea. I co-wrote one nonfiction book. It's called Looking for a Hero. It's about the most decorated Army veteran of the Vietnam War who died in alcoholic obscurity and why that was. Wrote it with a very distinguished military historian, Pete Maslowski. He's been a lifelong friend. Took us 10 years to write. Nobody wanted to publish it. It came out from the University of Nebraska Press. And one of the things I'm most proud of in my career. But that's a really good idea, actually. I might consider that. Because, as we all know, the press is the enemy of the people. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.